Today is Wednesday, February 16th, the year 2005. We're on the campus of Michigan State University in East Lansing. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. August G. Benson for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of the institution, which is being commemorated this year in 2005. As you can see, Dr. Benson, we have a tape recorder here for our oral history today. Do you give us permission to tape this interview?
I do.
Okay. I'd like to start first with some general questions about your background, personal background, and educational background before you came to Michigan State. Where were you born and raised, and where did you go to school prior to college?
I was born and raised in the Detroit area, just outside of Detroit, between Detroit and the farmland, which was an ideal place to be living and be brought up. Mm-hmm. And when I got through high school, I would take a few courses at Wayne State from time to time. But at that point, I had no idea that I would ever be college material. Not material so much, but have the opportunity to attend college.
Mm-hmm. What year were you born?
1917.
17. Mm-hmm. And what were your parents' names?
My father was August John Benson. My mother was May Fitzgerald Kennedy. My father was from Sweden, my mother from Ireland. They met in New York, married, and came to Detroit because that was the time, the beginning of the automobile industry and lots of jobs available.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So your early years, you went to, what school did you go to? Were you at a country school, or was it in your early elementary?
Well, they're in a town school.
A town school. Okay.
Yeah, it's a little town called Centerline.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're obviously growing up in the Great Depression, you had some experiences with that. How would you say what it was like in your age?
I was fairly fortunate. My father was a foreman. Plant in Detroit, and he worked all through the Depression. Mm-hmm. So he had a small income coming in. I know we had fellow classmates whose fathers never worked at all during their high school experience, and mm-hmm. tough times. I did work in the bowling alley 7 nights a week setting pins mm-hmm. to bring in a little extra money during the high school days.
Mm-hmm. What did you do after high school?
I was fortunate in the sense that my father, being a foreman, was able to get me a job in that company, Detroit Steel Products, I was a mail clerk. I started as a mail clerk. Well, I was one of the few in our class to get a job. Many of the students went into the CCC.
Okay.
And somewhere I kind of missed that because they all had good experiences. Mm-hmm. But I stayed with this company for 4 years, and then in 1938 we had a kind of a recession, and they laid off a number of the young people, and I was one of those that were laid off. I finally found another job with another steel company.
Mm-hmm. In that new job, was that in the office or was that on the line?
Well, first in that first job, I did get promoted one time from mail clerk to sales expediter, where I took orders around and got them processed through the credit department and other departments and before they were processed. So I got some good experience there. The second one, I worked in the storage and receiving and storage department in a steel company. It was quite educational and it was very useful.
Mm-hmm. Were you living at home at the time?
Yes, okay. I lived at home until I was 25. Mm-hmm. I might add, I had one other job. I the office, I was in charge of the office of a small company, a coal company. Mm-hmm. And they managed yard coal and brick coal. That is, they made coal into bricks and mm-hmm. sold them by the ton, so many bricks. Mm-hmm. And it was there that when the military service came along.
Okay. How would you describe Detroit at that time when you were newly graduated and a young man?
It was very active. At one time, right around some of those times, it was called the City of Champions when we had we had football, the Lions, and we had the Detroit Tigers, and then we had hockey. And so it was a very active city, and I spent a lot of time in it. In fact, I belonged to an organization called Allied Youth, a non-drinking organization whose founder or major sponsor was Henry Ford. And one time I was at a dance out at Greenfield Village, and Mr. Ford was there, and his wife and friends were there, and they participated in the dance. It was quite an interesting experience. I would say there were a lot of job opportunities. So from the time I was born till maybe I was 12, we had good life, and that was before the Depression hit. So it was a good life.
Some boom times until the Depression. So you followed the Tigers?
Yes, I did.
Heyday of the
sure did.
36 Tigers?
Went to their camp down in Lakeland, Florida.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They were in Lakeland at that time, even? What, looking at, let's maybe talk a little bit about World War II. Where were you when you first heard of Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor?
Well, maybe I should back up just a little bit and tell you where I was when I heard of the German attack on Poland.
Very true, very true.
I was up at Whitefish Point in Michigan. I had had trouble with hay fever and that kind of illness, and they told me to take a month off, go on up into northern Michigan and just take it easy. And I was up there right at Whitefish Point, and that was an interesting experience. But I came home, and then when I was ready to get in service.
That was September 39?
Right. And I was in the first draft. I had a low number, and I gave up my job, and they had a party and whatnot for me, and I went down, went through the whole process, and they stamped on there, rejected.
Rejected.
And I'd quit my job and whatnot, so I had to go back to. So when Pearl Harbor came, I was at home, and then like so many of the other young people, I was anxious to get into service. I waited a little while for the benefits of the company, who then had slow summer business and allowed me to leave without significant problem. And so I had lived at home until I was 25, until I got in service.
The so that news, was it the hay fever or the asthma that caused the rejection?
No, my vision.
Oh, your vision. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
It seems ironic that then you ended up as a career military man.
Well, it seems like after that, every time I went to an exam, I took a good look at the chart.
You had a good memory for that, yeah. Well, then what about Pearl Harbor? Where were you when you...
I was at home. It was on a Sunday morning, as I recall. And, of course, everyone was shocked. Maybe not everyone. Some of them, and I was fairly knowledgeable. Did a lot of reading. Maybe not as shocked as a lot of others.
What then? When did you actually go in service?
I went in May of 42. And I found in service that all the work experience I had as prior to service was very, very helpful to me, because ended up with an organization. They needed people to run their squadron office, all those details, the morning reports and whatnot. And so I moved quickly up to a tech sergeant.
Tech sergeant, okay.
And when I went to OCS.
And you had some college, right? You said at Wayne State, some courses?
Yeah,
but you didn't have a degree yet?
No.
Okay.
And there was a program called FERA, then the Federal Education Recovery Act, offered courses. And so I had a variety of courses.
Was that in the Army Air Corps, or was it just regular the Army?
I went into the Army Air Corps.
Okay.
I was went to basic training at Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, and I scored fairly well on the examinations. Having worked for the steel company, I knew which way the nuts and bolts went and all that stuff, and they tried to make an aircraft mechanic out of me. I held out to see if they'd send me to clerical school or personnel school, and they did. And I never quite understood why they were that receptive, but they were. And I went to a clerical school out at Fort Logan, Colorado then.
Okay. Did you have experience mostly stateside? Or when did you ultimately, or tell me a little bit about OCS.
Yeah, I went to Topeka, and I went into, they had a bomb group that was training crews to go overseas. And so I was there about 6 months, and we were opening a new base down in Dalhart, Texas. That's the Dust Bowl area. Okay. I took a cadre out. I was the acting first sergeant. And I helped recruit about 30 people to go on this group. Now, some of the people in the old group were trying to get rid of people and ship them out because that went away. And I kept trying to recruit other good people to join with us. And I went to Dalhart, and Dalhart had been a base, had been a glider base. And most of the winds down there, most of those gliders had gone in. Mm-hmm. So they changed it to a bomber training base. Mm-hmm. And I was there about 6 months when my orders to OCS came through.
Okay. Then where did you train in OCS?
Miami Beach.
In Miami
Beach?
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And was your goal to continue as a personnel officer, or did you
hope
to be in a combat arm?
Well, I was with the combat unit.
Okay, right.
I got out of OCS. They shipped about 2,000 second lieutenants from Miami Beach to Salt Lake City, Utah. Mm-hmm. When the train got over somewhere like Puebla, Colorado, they had to wait for another engine to pull them over the mountains. So a group of us in our car, we went down to the hospital there and rounded up as many nurses as we could. And then we had a big party there. And we were all full of energy. And so we ended up in Salt Lake City. And I was in Salt Lake City twice. The first time as a GI, and I thought I would be sent west. And no, I was sent back to Topeka. Mm-hmm. And then the second time I went as a second lieutenant, I thought I would go to Asia too. No, I and another second lieutenant were assigned 50 troops from that area. They were Hispanics from New Mexico and Arizona, and we were to take them to the port in New York. Mm-hmm. And that was another long train ride from Colorado, New York. I mean, from Utah. So, we got to New York where we'd turn them over to the commander and we'd go and have a big time. We never got off the base in New York.
Right?
We had to get them all ready for overseas. Mm-hmm. So we we had a long trip because of the transport we were on was called the Empress of Russia. And we were out with the convoy one day, and this Empress of Russia had a bad load of coal, and it turned around and went back to port, and we all stayed on the ship while they offloaded the bad load and all. So we were on the ship 17 days when the time they got to Greenock, Scotland.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So were there, the U-boats were probably active in that in that era, was it?
Yes, they were.
Yeah. Yeah. What was that experience like in crossing? And
well, the first time we were in a faster convoy. Second time we were in a slower one. But we got to an overseas depot, a replacement depot at Liverpool. And I was sent down to London with the major and I were sent down to London. He said, hey, let's get a sign in London and we can share an apartment and have a great time. Well, I didn't see that I could live with a major. Mm-hmm. With his income versus second lieutenant. So anyway, I had this experience with the bomber groups in the States, so I told them all about this, and I ended up with a bomber group in England at a place called Bedford. It was north of London. I went in there as a brand new second lieutenant, and I reported to an officer named Dave Myers. He was a captain, and he was very happy to see me because he wanted to get reassigned to a squadron so he could make major. So I showed up. I had all this experience from civilian life and was able to apply it both as a non-com and as an officer. And he assigned me to his office. And my first duty, assigned duty, was mud control officer. See, the mud would get from the mud on the runways. Mm-hmm. And cause real problems. And I had to get, from each squadron every day, I had to get about two or three men, so there were 35 or 40 men that were working. And finally, they cut a trench around all these paved areas so that if you got off there, you went down then. And well, anyway, it did allow me to get to know all the units on the campus quickly. Mm-hmm. Hmm. And it wasn't too long when he got me promoted to first lieutenant. And wasn't long after that where he got assigned out. He had been with the original group when the group left of the group from the U.S. to go to England. And so he was able to get his major.
What, that bomber group, was that B-17?
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm.
I had a great record.
That was all part of what, the 8th Air Force?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And so how long were you in Bedford?
Not quite 2 years.
Oh, okay.
I ended up there in September, arrived and left in about June of 2 years later.
Okay.
When the war came to an end, we were all wondering where are we going to be sent? We might be sent directly to the Far East. Mm-hmm. We might be sent back to the States for transfer to B-29s, or we might be sent to Germany as occupation air force. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. But in any event, the orders came through and we were to go to Casablanca.
Oh, really?
They had taken two bomb groups, one from England and one from Italy. Mm-hmm. Sent them to Casablanca, deactivated them, and assigned their personnel all across North Africa, Persian Gulf Command, and CBI, because they were getting ready at the end of the war to fly all these troops home, and the pressures were on. Mm-hmm. So they had to build up these air bases along the way. And I ended up spending time in Casablanca and in Tunisia.
Okay.
Good duty, actually. Mm-hmm. Pretty good duty. And so I spent another 6 months or a year there before eventually returning home.
Okay. At what point did you, make a decision to stay in as a career?
Well, I thought of marked time for a while. I didn't have the kind of job to go back to. I knew some limits. I had some limitations. And especially in education. And so I just kind of marked time. A lot of people were getting out. It was a mass thing. Let's all get out. And a couple of years later, I was stationed in Washington. The Air Force had 100,000 applications. Officers want to get back on active duty. But anyway, I just kind of marked time, and they began offering a regular commission versus a reserve commission. Mm-hmm. And I applied for that, and I got it. I got a regular commission. And if you had a regular commission, the Air Force and Army too, more so than the Navy, they had a lot of officers who did not have college degrees. Mm-hmm. And so they had a far-sighted program. And I ended up with being sent to Michigan.
University of Michigan?
University mm-hmm. of Michigan. A couple of friends of mine were in engineering. I was in business. And I managed to get my degree in business. I had exactly the number of credits and mm-hmm. no extra. So that period right in there and those developments clarified my status that I was going to stay in mm-hmm. to 20 anyway.
So you were on active duty during the time when you were in school, I think. So, and that was different than the GI Bill, but
because
the government paid for it, didn't they? Yeah, and part of that because the idea you had a commitment beyond.
Yeah.
Okay. And then in the 1950s, where you served in a variety of locations, where what would you say was a highlight of some of your?
Well, a highlight. I had a little time I had to serve. They sent me back. They were sending me back to North Africa, but I went through Paris because North Africa and European command had been combined, joined. And I got there, and they had a need for an officer, and I just happened to be the right person at the right time. They had a project with three major airlines, Pan American, TWA, and American Overseas Airlines. And what they were doing, these bases I told you about spread out, well, all the troops were eligible to leave. They couldn't hire civil service people because they couldn't pay civil service rates enough money to get them to go to some of these bases, which were challenging. Mm-hmm. And so they needed somebody to work with these airlines. So that was my job, project. And I worked with the three airlines for ran about a year, and it worked out. Really, it was challenging, and I got a commendation out of it.
Uh-huh.
And so then I got transferred back to Washington, and I served in Washington for a couple of years until they sent me to Michigan, University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. That's where I got a degree and I got a wife and a family started at
U of N.
U of N. Yeah. But I had no time for anything but study. Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
How was it ultimately that you came to Michigan State?
Well, we were, among other assignments, I was assigned to Hawaii. I had a three-year tour in Hawaii, and I had a degree then. And they were making everybody who had a degree apply for ROTC duty because they had some officers teaching ROTC that didn't have degrees. Mm-hmm. They were anxious to correct that. So I applied, and I had Michigan State, Purdue, my wife's state, Notre Dame, all these. And I heard that my name had been submitted to Michigan State. This program was mandatory, whereas Michigan's was voluntary. So Michigan State had a staff of about 15 officers, and Michigan about 5. Anyway, I heard I'd been nominated to Michigan State, and I had a friend of mine. We'd been stationed in Tunis together. He was a Michigan State grad. Ran the Masonic Temple in Detroit, the big temple there, mm-hmm. and knew John Hanna and so forth. So I wrote him and asked him to put in a good word, and he did. And we ended up coming to the state. While I was here one summer, they allowed you to go to school for summer. And I had brought with me, I had picked up some credits along the way, Ohio State. See, I was stationed in Dayton, Ohio, too. And Ohio State had an extension program. So when I got here with ROTC, I found I had equivalent of 12 credits. And then they let you go full-time one summer. I got 12 more, and pretty there I had 24, only 45. I needed less than 20 or thereabouts there to get the master's. Mm-hmm. So I got into it more seriously, and I had a good advisor and a fellow named Walter Johnson, and in fact, I served for some courses like independent study. I was advisor to a fraternity here. Mm-hmm. I tried to help them. I was helping. I was going through the ROCC, because that's, see who had a academic standing, mm-hmm. as they would be eligible for going in.
In the fraternity?
Fraternity, so they wouldn't be wasting their time chasing a lot of people who are not eligible. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of fun. But we found that the campus and community were such a great place, both the campus and community, to raise a family, and just generally speaking, because when I came to Michigan State, a lot of the faculty had served in WW2. Mm-hmm. And so I got to know a lot of them while I was teaching ROTC. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That whole cohort that President Hanna brought in
certainly
it shaped this university significantly.
Sure did.
So you were part of that wave coming
in. We were fortunate.
Uh-huh. I forgot to ask your wife's name.
Mary.
Mary?
Uh-huh. She's a nurse, incidentally.
Uh-huh. What were your first impressions of campus? Obviously, you had been at Michigan, but your first impressions back, you gave a little bit of ideas about that. How would you describe the university then?
I was quite impressed, because at Michigan, that university then, parts of it were mixed up with the community and, mm-hmm. and whatnot. So I was very, very impressed, and we were in a process in ROTC from switching to mandatory to voluntary here at Michigan State. Mm-hmm. It took some time before this was all worked out, but I got to know quite a few people on campus, and I was very favorably impressed.
Air Force and Army ROTC, were they separate or were they together?
They were
together?
Separate.
They were separate. Okay. Yeah.
We worked closely with them.
Mm-hmm. And was the focus of the MSU ROTC program in Air Force at that time, was that to get pilots or was it just to get all officers?
Officers.
Or
pilots and non-pilots.
Both. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
There were.
Mm-hmm. So how many years were you here in the ROTC? Then?
I was here 4 years.
Okay.
And normally it's a three-year tour. You can expand four, and we did. We were just enjoying campus. And,
mm-hmm. and that was toward the end of your... It was at the end of your active duty career?
Close to it. Mm-hmm. I ended up going to Wichita, Kansas for 2 years.
Okay.
Now, I tried hard to get assigned to the Air Force Academy. And had I been able to get that, chances are I would have stayed on for 4 years or maybe even retired out there. Mm-hmm. That country is so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And then after, what was it that affected your decision to leave the service after 20 years?
Well, a couple of things. I had a good career.
What was your rank at the end?
Light colonel.
Lieutenant
colonel. Mm-hmm. And I'd gone about as far as I could. The Air Force, you have a situation where you've got flying officers and non-flying. And obviously, as flying is the operation or life of the Air Force, so the flying officers usually got into the command positions. Mm-hmm. And they had a lot of, they were given other assignments preparing them for command, like personnel or supply or logistics. So kind of generally speaking, we did kind of understood that the chance are you would light colonel was about as far as you could go. But that was pretty good starting from grade. So that was one thing. The other thing, I've been fortunate most of my career, but I had a lousy person I worked for. I signed to Wichita, and I was working for a fellow down there who was an alcoholic. I used to say alcoholic asshole. Mm. What he was, and this would make an interesting study, but they commissioned, when the war broke out, they commissioned a lot of GIs that had been in service. Mm-hmm. Some of these guys had been in service 15 or 20 years, like this guy. And he did his best work was at the bar. Mm. And he never really became an officer in the context of being an officer. Mm-hmm. When I went down there, I was kind of open-minded, when he gave me my performance report, it was low, so I took him in front of the base commander, and they raised it and all that stuff, but that still is, I can tell you about this guy, because he represented a group of GIs, directly commissioned, with little or no education, maybe high school.
Yeah, non-professional by modern standards. Yeah.
And when I went down there, mm-hmm. here, I'm coming, I got a master's coming down there, and he doesn't have education, he doesn't have a lot of things, and